How can he be induced to overcome these weaknesses? Carnegie. In your question, you have, consciously or otherwise, described the actual condition of the majority of people. Lack of ambition stands near the head of the list of causes of failure. There is no hope of success for such a person until he has been fired with sufficient ambition to cause him to want something he does not possess. Desire based on a definite motive is, as we have stated many times, the beginning of all achievements. And right here, I wish to call your attention to an important fact we have not mentioned previously, namely, that every successful person owes his success, in a large measure, to the influence of some other person who crossed his life somewhere and somehow. Take your own case, for example. You came to interview me for the purpose of writing a story about my personal achievements. Before you were through with the interview, I influenced you to change your entire plan of life, give up your aim of becoming a lawyer, and give the world a practical philosophy of individual achievement. In a similar manner, every successful man comes under the influence of some other person who fires his imagination with an idea that becomes obsessional with him. Sometimes the source of this outside inspiration is attained by remote control, through the reading of a book. But always there is a turning point in every successful person's life which marks the place at which he came under the influence of another mind that inspired him with higher aims and nobler purposes. Very often successful men lose sight of the original source of their inspiration, and not infrequently do they forget it conveniently because they prefer to have the world believe their achievements to be of their own doing entirely. Hill. That is an entirely new thought, Mr. Carnegie, but I can see that it is sound. Then is it not true that an important part of organized thinking consists in one's deliberate efforts to associate with those who are capable of inspiring him with higher and nobler aims? Carnegie. Yes, and I might add that the wise man never wastes his time with anyone from whom he cannot acquire benefits or to whom he cannot contribute something worthwhile in one form or another. Personal associations are important because everyone acquires something of the philosophy, the personality, and the mental attitude of those with whom he associates closely. As I have stated, there is a law of nature which controls this. Hill. By the selfsame rule, is it not also true that many of a man's destructive qualities, such as a negative mental attitude, are acquired from association with others? Carnegie. Yes, that is true. I have never yet heard of a young person getting into serious trouble that did not grow out of his association with undesirable characters. Human associations are much more responsible for one's success or failure in life than most people believe them to be. No wise person would any more form close friendships with people with negative minds than one would drink water from a well he knew to be contaminated with disease germs. Human traits are contagious, both the good and the bad. Hill. As you unfold this subject of organized thinking, Mr. Carnegie, there seems to be no end to the conditions and circumstances that enter into it. Carnegie. That is right. The conditions which influence organized thinking are, in fact, as numerous as are the facts which enter into all human intercourse. Every word a man speaks, every word spoken in his presence, every thought a man thinks, modifies his thinking habits in one way or another. Naturally, if a man jockeys himself into such a relationship with others that he associates only with those who inspire him to think noble thoughts and engage in commendable deeds, he benefits by improving the nature of his own thoughts. The reverse is true if by carelessness or indifference he allows himself to drift into the company of people whose minds are negative. Hill. Then you wouldn't say it was selfish for a man to refuse to associate with any except those from whom he can gain some sort of benefit or contribute something worthwhile? Carnegie. That might be called selfishness, but it is a justifiable form of selfishness. No matter by what name it is called, it is essential for success through organized thinking. A man does not hesitate to demand the best food he can get for his physical body, although he may know there are people who are in want of even the coarsest of food. Why, therefore, should a man be less careful about the food he feeds his mind? And make no mistake about it, every influence that reaches a man through his association with others constitutes mental food for his mind. I have seen tramps fishing discarded food from swill barrels, but I have also seen men who were not tramps fishing mental food from the minds of their associates, which was far more detrimental to their well-being than would be the discarded food from a swill barrel. This is not a pretty simile, but it is accurate. Hill, when you speak of daily associates, do you have reference to a man's business or social associates? Carnegie, I have reference to all his associates with whom he enters into friendly intercourse. Listed in the order of their importance, from the viewpoint of the influence a man's associates have on him, I would say that his family associates come first, then his business or occupational associates, then his social friends, and lastly his casual associates. No relationship is as important as that of a man's family associates. Here is where most men are made or unmade, according to the nature of their home relationships. This relationship exercises a powerful influence in a man's life, and it begins at birth and continues all through life. That old saying that a man can be made or broken by the influence of his wife is true in all but a few rare cases where a man is strong enough to throw off the influence of a negative wife. On the other hand, a clever wife can, and often she does, inspire her husband to aim higher and achieve the object of his aim. Fortunate indeed is the man who selects a wife whose influence on him is inspiring and constructive. Hill. Of course, you have not intentionally overlooked mentioning a man's mastermind associates as being an important factor in his business or occupational achievements. Would these not come before all other influences? Carnegie. As far as one's business achievements are concerned, yes. But if you have reference to a man's success as a whole, I still say that his family relationships come first, because here is where a man has his more intimate relationships, and it is these that make or disrupt his peace of mind. The ideal relationship, of course, is one in which a man's wife, if he is married, becomes also a member of his mastermind alliance. She may not participate in the business conferences he has with the other members of his alliance, but she can have a lot to do with the mental attitude in which he enters these conferences, and in that way exercise a powerful influence on the group as a whole that affect him. Hill, you emphasize the importance of knowing well your mastermind allies. You go on the theory, I suppose, that an enemy recognized is an enemy half-controlled? Carnegie, yes, and you might add that if you know a great deal about your enemies, you stand a fair chance of being able to convert them into friends. The habit of underrating one's enemies or competitors is a costly habit. No organized thinker indulges in such costly mistakes. The organized thinker accepts as grist everything that comes to his mill, but he takes care to separate the wheat from the chaff in the grinding process. The chaff can be converted into useful service if it is recognized and classified. Hill. Meaning by your simile, just what, Mr. Carnegie? Carnegie. Well, I'll give you an illustration of exactly what I mean. I once had a close business associate whose home life became dangerously disturbed by his interests in another woman. This man's wife came to me with her story and asked my aid in breaking up the affair. I went right to work on it, not by mentioning the affair to my associate, but dealing indirectly with the woman in the case. Inside of a month, I had convinced the woman of the inappropriateness of the whole affair and of the damage it was destined to do my business associate if it were not discontinued. The details I cannot mention, but suffice it to say that the home relationship of my associate was satisfactorily restored, thereby saving embarrassment to many people. If I had ignored the facts when they were first called to my attention, I would eventually have lost an able business associate, and his wife would have lost a fine husband. By using common sense and working together, under the principle of organized thinking, his wife and I averted what would otherwise have become a tragedy. Hill. Oh, I see what you mean. Organized thinking makes it necessary for a man to depart from his regular routine when emergencies, such as the one you have related, threaten to interfere with the attainment of his own goal in life. Is that the idea, Mr. Carnegie? Carnegie, that is just what I mean. It was not my responsibility to interfere with my business associate's private life, but it was my privilege to do so, and I acted on that privilege in what I considered the best interest of all concerned. Hill, suppose that your efforts to deal with the woman in this case had not been successful. Would you have given up the matter? Carnegie, the organized thinker never gives up anything he undertakes until he has exhausted every effort to finish it, and you may put that down as another essential of organized thinking. No, if my first effort had failed, I would have tried another plan, and still another. As a last resort, I might have disassociated myself from my associate until he learned the error of his ways, then have made a new alliance with him. Every problem has a solution of some sort, although it may not always be the solution one would like. The trouble with people who do not organize their thinking is that they give up and quit when they run into opposition. Quitting never solved any problem. Hill, then persistence is also an important factor in organized thinking. Carnegie, indeed it is. As a matter of fact, persistence is a key word in all forms of individual achievement. Without it, no one can go very far in any undertaking. Persistence takes its place along with action. The two are inseparable. Hill, how may one acquire persistence, Mr. Carnegie? Carnegie, by developing the power of the will. Persistence is nothing but an indomitable will plus a definite motive to inspire action. Bring together these three factors, motive, action, and willpower, and they result in what we call persistence. Hill, I suppose one develops the power of will in the same manner by expressing a definite desire or motive in terms of action. Carnegie, yes, the power of will responds only to motive, but it becomes stronger the more it is used. When a man takes possession of his own willpower, he has all the other faculties of his mind under his control, for it is the boss of them all. Hill, then one cannot become an organized thinker without gaining control of his willpower. Is that correct? Carnegie, that is precisely correct. And do not forget that the will responds to controlled habits based on definite motives, which is the same as saying that the way to gain control of the will is by developing action habits that are related to the exercise of the will. Hill, thank you, Mr. Carnegie, for explaining the elements and importance of organized thought in such detail. Every student of this philosophy should have the word action burned into his consciousness, for it is one of the key words of the entire philosophy. Andrew Carnegie. If you cannot get that which you want, you can change your desires and want something you can get. If you wish to know the motive which inspires one to concentrate his mind on a definite purpose, observe the actions of those who are in love. Obsessional desire, based on intense emotion, is the source of all genius. Chapter 3. Controlled Attention. Hidden in the two words controlled attention is a strange power that is sufficient to remove all the ordinary self-imposed limitations which people accept and by which they are bound throughout their lives. The power is literally mental dynamite, as it is capable of blasting the cause of self-imposed limitations and giving one the means by which he may take charge of his own mind. When you master this chapter, you will understand more fully why one must have a definite major purpose in order to attain success. You will know also why one's definite major purpose should be written out, memorized, and repeated often. You will understand why one's mental attitude plays such an important part in carrying out the object of one's major purpose or any minor purpose. The subject of controlled attention is the basis of many sects and religions, although it may be called by other names. It has been the major weapon used by powerful military leaders, some of whom have not always made constructive use of it. Through this chapter, we shall get a better understanding of the mastermind principle, the results of which have baffled men of science and astounded laymen who have witnessed its operations. The alliance of two or more minds, working in perfect harmony for the attainment of a definite purpose, has the effect of stimulating the mind of each person in the alliance, and results in providing the members of the alliance, or some individual in the group, with a source of knowledge that sometimes cannot be traced to the accumulated knowledge of any of the individuals. This result we are familiar with because it is a result that is taking place in the research laboratories and the business and industrial councils throughout the world almost as a daily routine. We see evidence on every hand that such a combination of minds gives men vision, courage, imagination, and initiative which they do not possess when they act independently and alone, and we know that this power is available even to men whose avowed purpose in its use is the destruction of the best that civilization has given the world. Andrew Carnegie included the principle of controlled attention as one of the principles of individual achievement, but even the great steel master failed to associate this principle with the means by which civilization may be advanced. He saw in it a power that is adaptable to one's needs in the solution of economic and personal problems of a material nature, but beyond this point, he made no mention of its possibilities. Mr. Carnegie readily acknowledged that his huge fortune was accumulated solely through the efforts of a combination of minds consisting of some 20 men who were allied with him as a mastermind group for the purpose of making and marketing steel. He acquired the technique necessary to induce those men to work with him in a spirit of harmony. He knew that the creative vision, imagination, initiative, and inspiration produced through this mastermind alliance were great, but he made no attempt to explain the source of the superpower they gave him. Since Mr. Carnegie first brought this principle to my attention, more than a quarter of a century of intense research into the causes of its power has been carried on. The minds of thousands of people have been explored, their reactions to thought stimuli have been examined, and conclusions have been reached which may be of the utmost importance to this and future generations in the matter of adjustment of human relationships. Come with me now for a brief elementary lesson in organic chemistry, for here is where we find the first convincing clue to what happens when two or more minds are blended in a spirit of harmony for the attainment of a single purpose. In chemistry, we learn that two or more elements of an entirely different nature can be so combined that they produce something different from either of the elements. For illustration, water, which is known in chemistry as H2O, is a compound consisting of two parts of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen, but the result is neither oxygen nor hydrogen. This marrying of the elements produces an entirely new product. We also learn in chemistry that certain harmless drugs can be so compounded that they become deadly poisonous, while still other combinations of drugs added to the poison will neutralize its poisonous effect. Throughout nature, we see that every atom of matter and every unit of energy is definitely modified by its nearest associates. Vegetation, the things that grow out of the ground, are definitely modified by the elements of the soil on which they feed, a fact that is well known to every farmer and every horticulturist. Yes, the atoms of matter are influenced by the presence of their neighbors, the same as people are. The world in which we live and the material portion of the universe which we can observe are made up of electrons, which, in final analysis, consist of positive and negative units of energy so arranged that the two forces balance each other and are practically inseparable by any method known to science. The material portion of the universe consists, as far as science has been able to determine the facts, of only two things, energy and matter. And it appears, if one wishes to be strictly technical in the statement of facts, that the so-called material portion of the universe is nothing but energy, since obviously the electrons of matter are known to be nothing but two opposing forms of energy, one pushing and the other pulling in such a manner as to neutralize their combined energy. Taking our cue from the chemistry of matter, we come now to the analysis of the power of thought. Obviously, thought is energy, and for all that science has learned about it, or its cause, it may be precisely the same sort of energy that holds the opposing forces of the electron together. If that is true, then it is clear that the energy of thought responds to the same modifying influences that change the nature of the elements of matter, one of which, as we have seen, is the manner in which the atoms of matter are combined. There are two facts of which we are sure. First, that the nature of matter can be changed by combining the elements of other matter, and second, that the nature of thought can be modified and changed by the alliance of two or more minds, and this despite the nature of the alliance, or for what purpose it is made. These are facts so well known, even to laymen, that they are readily accepted as such. We know that there are certain types of minds which, when they contact each other through any sort of intercourse, become definitely antagonistic to each other. In this circumstance, we find a reasonable hypothesis for the belief that the chemistry of the brain and the chemistry of matter in other fields are the same, that the same law of nature which changes harmless chemical elements into deadly poison, by the mere act of combining them, changes also the vibrations of thought when mixed in certain combinations to an antagonizing influence. In other words, there are certain combinations of thought energy which fight the moment they come into contact with each other. Nor is this fact demonstrable alone in the relationship of two or more individuals. It can also be seen in the operations of an individual mind, for it is well known that there are types of thought which repel as soon as they come together. The emotion of fear and the emotion of faith, for example, are so unfriendly that both cannot possibly occupy the brain at the same time. One or the other must, and it always does, dominate. There are certain means by which an individual may determine which of these two emotions, or any other emotions, shall dominate his brain, and one of the most important of these methods is controlled attention. As a part of this description, I must now call attention to a law of nature through which like attracts like. We sometimes call this the law of harmonious attraction. Through its operation, things that are suited to one another, in the great scheme of life, have a natural tendency to get together. We see this law in operation in connection with vegetation that grows from the soil. Through some strange and unknown process, this law manages to bring together the chemical elements of the soil and combine them with the units of energy of the elements of the air so as to produce every living thing that grows from the ground. Here there is no antagonism, no fighting among the elements of matter or the units of energy. They do their work in response to the law of harmonious attraction without opposition among themselves. When we come to the relationship between men, we find another situation through which the law of harmonious attraction is often disregarded and unfriendly forces of thought energy break up relationships of harmony. Sometimes this happens because of man's ignorance of the law of harmonious attraction. Sometimes it is the result of man's deliberate substitution of negative thoughts, which are known to be destructive of the influence of the law of harmonious attraction. The person who has mastered this philosophy and has formed the habit of applying it in all his relationships with other people finds himself benefited by the law of harmonious attraction. He has conditioned his brain to attract to himself only such people and material things as he desires. Now let us see how he goes about the process of conditioning his brain so as to enable him to adapt himself to the influence of the law of harmonious attraction, viz. 1. Definiteness of purpose. He decides precisely what he wants, lays out a plan for acquiring it, and then proceeds to concentrate the major portion of his thoughts and deeds on that end, following his thoughts with appropriate physical action. Here, then, enters the principle of controlled attention, and let us not overlook the fact that this has the effect of giving him the benefit of the law of harmonious attraction in two different ways. First, he attracts the forces of a positive mental attitude which create harmony within his own mind. Second, He attracts people and material things which harmonize with the nature of his purpose. Through controlled attention, and by that method alone, one may impress the nature of his desires, aims, and plans upon his subconscious mind, where the law of harmonious attraction appears to find contact with them. 2. The Master Mind. Having made the first step in the development of the habit of controlled attention by the adoption of a definite major purpose, he must form a master mind alliance with others who have the necessary experience, education, native ability, and who have been supplied with the necessary motive to help attain the object of his major purpose. This master mind relationship intensifies the application of the principle of controlled attention because the alliance creates a powerful mass psychology which gives one increased self-reliance, imagination, enthusiasm, initiative, and the will to win. A man will keep on moving in the direction of his definite major purpose when he is associated with others who lend him aid and encouragement, whereas he would be inclined to slow down and to divert his attention from his major objective if he worked alone. The mastermind alliance, when it is keyed up and actively engaged in carrying out some definite objective, is controlled attention in its highest form. Such an alliance keeps one continuously reminded of his purpose in life, particularly where one is associated daily with the members of his mastermind group, as are the successful leaders of industrial and business organizations. 3. Applied Faith. The man who has adopted a definite major purpose and has surrounded himself with a group of other people in a mastermind alliance and is actively engaged in carrying out the object of his alliance thereby demonstrates his faith in his ability to attain his objective. Therefore, the element of faith enters into his application of the principle of controlled attention, thus further intensifying his power of concentration. By the time this third step has been taken in developing the habit of controlled attention, one's mental attitude has become predominantly positive. Many of the self-imposed limitations of doubt and discouragement and lack of self-reliance have disappeared. One moves with definiteness in all he does. He has no room left in his mind for thoughts of failure. He is so busily engaged in carrying out the object of his major purpose that he has no time to hesitate or procrastinate. Moreover, he has no desire to do so. The third step in the development of controlled attention would be sufficient to ensure success in a majority of cases, but the master of this philosophy does not stop here. He proceeds to freeze the gains he has made by taking the fourth step. 4. Going the extra mile. The application of this principle ensures continuous action. It brings into operation the principle of increasing returns through which one's efforts are greatly multiplied. It creates an added momentum behind one's efforts which inspires both the individual and his mastermind associates, as well as others who are definitely related to the object of his definite major purpose. It also serves to modify his mental attitude by making it more positive. While it may not bring him direct material benefits on every occasion that this principle is applied, it has the general effect of creating goodwill and attracting the cooperation of others in a spirit of friendliness. Thus, it serves as fuel to feed the fire of controlled attention. But this is not the stopping point. The master of this philosophy further ensures his successful attainment of the object of his definite major purpose by taking the fifth step in the development of the habit of controlled attention. 5. Organized Individual Endeavor. Through the application of this principle, one organizes his plans, then, with the aid of his mastermind allies, he analyzes his plans, tests them, and makes sure that they are sound. By this time, he has established a sound reason for his faith. Therefore, he moves with self-assurance that practically defies opposition. He is no longer held back by indecision and doubt. He knows precisely what he wants, he has definite plans for acquiring what he wants, and he is actively engaged in carrying out his plans, flanked and aided by mastermind allies in whom he has confidence, and who, in turn, inspire him with greater confidence in himself and his plans. But he does not stop here. He takes the sixth step in consolidating his gains by applying another important principle of this philosophy, viz. 6. Self-discipline. Through the aid of this principle, the emotions are harnessed and brought under control. He no longer dissipates his energies, either by the overindulgence of his positive emotions or by giving expression to his negative emotions. His mind begins to function like a perfectly constructed piece of machinery, with no lost motion, no dissipation of energy. He has acquired the art of transmutation of his emotions. Therefore, his negative emotions, if and when they present themselves to his mind, are converted into positive action. He has begun to acquire complete control over his faculty of will, with the aid of which all the other departments of the mind are brought under his control and made to do constructive duty. He is approaching the apex of efficiency in the art of controlled attention. From here on, he has everything under control, but there are still other steps to be taken which put the finishing touches on the consolidation of his gains over himself and the circumstances of his life which affect his attainment of his major definite purpose. Moving more swiftly now, because of the gains he has made through the 6 steps he has taken, he takes the 7th step, viz. 7. Creative vision. By the time the previous 6 steps have been taken, the faculty of the imagination will have become so keen and alert that it begins to function automatically, thus further consolidating one's efforts to develop the habit of controlled attention. By this time, the subconscious mind will have swung into action on its own account, and it will have begun to express itself through plans and ideas that will appear in the form of hunches. New opportunities will begin mysteriously to appear, and new and unexpected forms of cooperation from others will begin to present themselves. Everything he touches will appear to become a tool placed in his hands with which he may promote the object of his definite major purpose. Even the law of chance will appear to be operating in his favor. His friends will begin to speak of him as one who is blessed by luck. But let no one be deceived on this point. Back of these favorable circumstances, what will appear from all directions is a definite cause, and the master of this philosophy will understand that this cause may be explained by the application of the 7 principles here mentioned. But the person who has mastered this entire philosophy will not be content to rest on his oars at this point. He will proceed to further consolidate his gains in the development of controlled attention by taking the 8th step. 8. Organized thought. Long before this point will have been reached, the master of this philosophy will have stopped guessing, and he will have formed the habit of building plans based on known facts or reasonable hypotheses of facts. As a matter of fact, he will have begun, simultaneously with the adoption of a definite major purpose, to organize his thinking. By no means should it be assumed that he will wait until he has taken the 8th step in the development of controlled attention to apply the principle of organized thought. At this point, however, this principle will have become obviously a necessity in the development of the habit of controlled attention. Remember, we are now talking about the habit of controlled attention, the foundation for which must be laid by the application of organized thought, beginning with the adoption of a definite major purpose. 9. Learning from defeat. By this time, the student of this philosophy will have acquired the habit of converting every experience of his life into some definite benefit. Defeat will have become nothing but a signal for greater and more determined effort. He will have acquired the habit of searching for the seed of an equivalent benefit that is to be found in all forms of defeat. Defeat, therefore, will become a form of useful fuel with which he feeds the fire of his own willpower. He will not only convert current defeats into an urge to greater endeavor, but he will have acquired the habit of going back into his memory and profiting by all his previous defeats. This he will accomplish by taking retrospective inventory of himself every few months, thus enabling himself to analyze defeat from its results through the lapse of time sufficient to remove the sting of the experience. By this time, the master of this philosophy will have become literally a giant of power compared with his former self, and there will be no space left in his brain for the housing of fear, discouragement, worry, or self-limitations of any other nature. He will know what he wants and where he is going in life, and he will recognize that he is well on his way toward his destination. The road ahead of him will be clear, and although it may have many curves beyond which he cannot see, he will know that when he reaches these, the road will continue onward toward his destination. This is a glorious feeling, as every person who has experienced noteworthy achievement can testify. Having learned the art of converting defeat into a stimulus for greater effort, the student of this philosophy goes the 10th step in the development of controlled attention. 10. Inspiration. The gains attained through the application of the 9 principles here described lead to the development of the habit of enthusiasm, the action-producing quality that inspires one to take the initiative instead of being told what to do. The inspired feeling of enthusiasm takes the drudgery out of work and converts one's physical action into a pleasant experience, thus simplifying the development of controlled attention. Enthusiasm in connection with any plan, purpose, or motive automatically leads to the concentration of attention upon that subject. Through the principle of inspiration, the dominating thoughts of one's mind are quickly impressed upon the subconscious mind, where they are acted upon. Thus, the person whose mind is dominated by enthusiasm has the direct support of what is assumed to be the connecting link between the conscious mind and infinite intelligence. At this point, he has attained a high degree of efficiency in the application of controlled attention. Meanwhile, the master of this philosophy will have added momentum to his efforts in support of the 10 principles here described by the application of the 11th principle, through which he will have taken the next step in developing the habit of controlled attention, viz. 11. Attractive personality. While this is mentioned as the 11th step in the development of the habit of controlled attention, the student will have begun applying this principle immediately following his adoption of a definite major purpose. By application of the qualities of an attractive personality, he will have removed much of the opposition of other people, and he will have attracted the friendly cooperation of many allies other than those allied with him in his mastermind group. He will have also improved his own mental attitude, thus preparing the way for the development of any desired habit, including the habit of controlled attention. It is obvious, therefore, that controlled attention is the result of the application of all the principles here mentioned, and not a matter of chance. It is obvious also that the method by which the habit of controlled attention is developed involves no effort beyond the ability of the average person. It calls for no special training or education other than that here mentioned. It is a success quality well within the reach of the person of average ability. Its development calls for no unreasonable amount of sacrifice or labor, the major requirements being the will to win and a willingness to pay the price of achievement in terms of honest application. Having mastered these 11 principles through systematic application and use, the student of this philosophy finds himself pushed forward into the 12th and last step in the development of the habit of controlled attention. In mastering the 11 principles, he has automatically developed the 12th, and lo, he finds himself the master of himself, the master of his fate, the captain of his soul. Although only 12 of the principles of this philosophy have been considered, the person who has mastered these is now in possession of his own mind. He knows what he wants. He has a plan for acquiring it. He has surrounded himself with trustworthy aids in acquiring the object of his definite major purpose. He feels the thrill of personal power. He has the necessary self-discipline to enable him to use this power wisely. Nay, he has no desire to use it in any other than a constructive manner that benefits all whom it influences. He has become a constructive unit of the great American way of life. And as such, he has given himself immunity against the subtle forces seeking to destroy the American form of self-determination and personal freedom. He has learned how to acquire his needs without damaging others. He no longer desires something for nothing, for he has learned a better way of acquiring his needs. He has found peace and harmony within his own mind. He has learned to accept the circumstances of life as he finds them and to make the most of them. He has acquired the art of peaceful and harmonious negotiation with others, through which he relates himself to other people in a manner that works for the good of all. Let us now give attention to another feature of controlled attention, which suggests the way to personal power through a combination of principles. As I have stated, there is a chemistry of the brain through which the mind power of individuals is modified by the influence of one mind on another. This fact is obvious even to the layman who has given no particular study to the subject of mental phenomena or personalities. We have seen also that in the field of organic chemistry, certain harmless elements may be so combined as to create a deadly poison. From these observations, we may safely assume that everything, from the individual atom of matter to a human being, is modified or changed in some form by the presence of other things. Knowing these facts to be such, we shall have no difficulty in assuming that the presence, in the mind, of a combination of thoughts may convert them into a power that cannot be identified with any individual thought, and one that may be greater than all of them combined. For example, we know from observation and experience that the following principles, when assembled in the mind through a combination of thoughts, may produce mind power bordering upon the miraculous. A. Definiteness of purpose. B. Self-discipline through control of the emotions. C. Controlled attention. D. Autosuggestion applied to the object of one's purpose. E. The power of will actively engaged. Here is a combination of principles capable of producing sufficient power for the solution of almost any problem by which one is confronted. The power comes from the combination, not from any single principle. Let us see how the principles are applied to produce power. Let us say that a man is faced by one of the commonest of all problems, the need of a certain amount of money for some specific purpose within a specified time. There are two major ways of dealing with the problem. First, by worrying about it but doing nothing to raise the money. This is the usual way of handling such problems. Second, by combining the five principles here mentioned and going after the money in earnest. The amount of money required is known, and one has made up his mind to get it. That is definiteness of purpose. The mind is put to work, through the faculty of the imagination, acquiring the money to the exclusion of all other problems. That is controlled attention. The mind is cleared of all fear and doubt that the money cannot be procured. That is self-discipline. The control of the emotion of fear thus prepares the mind for the exercise of faith. The mind is put to work, through the faculty of the imagination, on creating something of an equivalent value that is to be given in return for the money, or for its temporary use, and it is kept at work until it singles out one specific idea. That is autosuggestion. The mind is given repeated suggestions that the amount of money desired will be procured, no matter what the cost may be or what conditions have to be complied with, and there it remains, set, determined, persistent. That is willpower in action. Lincoln's mind was like a piece of steel, very hard to scratch anything on it, and almost impossible, after you get it on, to rub it out. When these five principles are combined and applied in the manner described, with variations to suit each different circumstance, the subconscious mind goes to work and creates a plan, sometimes a variety of plans, by which the money may be procured. If one experiences failure, it is because there has been a slackening of effort in concentration with one or more of these principles. I have seen this combination of principles produce results that were almost unbelievable. I have heard highly successful men endorse this combination of principles as having superpower, which they made no effort to explain because it seems inexplicable. The combination of the five principles I have just mentioned provides one with power that is not attributable to any one of these principles alone. The experiences of men of great achievement bear this out. First, we shall hear from Thomas A. Edison, whose statement on the subject is quoted as nearly verbatim as memory will permit. "You ask me," said Mr. Edison, "to name the most important essential in the field of invention. Well, I can describe it very briefly. It consists, first, of definite knowledge as to what one wants to achieve, definiteness of purpose. One must fix his mind on that purpose with that sort of persistence which knows no such word as impossible, and begin searching for that which he seeks, making use of all the accumulated knowledge on the subject he can find, drawing upon his own experience, and making use of the experience of other people, the master mind, controlled attention, auto-suggestion. He must keep on searching, no matter how many times his search leads to a dead-end street, power of will. He must refuse to be influenced by the fact that someone else may have tried the same idea without success, self-discipline, mastery of fear and doubt. He must keep himself sold on the idea that the solution of his problem exists somewhere and that he will find it. Auto-suggestion. Then Mr. Edison went on to say, when a man makes up his mind to solve a problem, he may at first meet with dogged opposition, but if he holds on and keeps searching, he will be sure to find some sort of a solution. I never knew the plan to fail. A combination of all five of the principles is involved here. The trouble with most people, he continued, is that they quit before they start. By this he meant, of course, that self-imposed limitations prohibit most people from beginning tasks which they might easily complete if they made a start and kept on going, in the right sort of mental attitude. In all my experience, Mr. Edison said, I do not recall ever having found the solution to any problem connected with invention through my first effort, with the exception of the talking machine. And one of the most surprising of all things is the fact that when I have discovered that for which I am searching, I generally find that the answer was within my reach all the time, but nothing but persistence and a will to win would have uncovered it. Now let us hear from Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the modern telephone. I discovered the principle of the long-distance telephone while searching for the means of producing a mechanical hearing aid for the benefit of my wife, whose hearing was impaired. I made up my mind to find that for which I was searching if it required the remainder of my life. After innumerable failures, I finally uncovered the principle for which I was searching and was astounded at its simplicity. I was still more astounded to discover that the principle I revealed was not only beneficial in the construction of a mechanical hearing aid, but it served also as a means of sending the sound of the voice over a wire. Dr. Bell made use of all five of the principles here described, although he may have done so unconsciously. Another discovery that grew out of my investigations, said Dr. Bell, was the fact that when a man gives his brain an order to produce a definite result and stands by that order, it seems to have the effect of giving him a second sight that enables him to see right through ordinary problems. What this power is, I cannot say. All I know is that it exists, and it becomes available only when a man is in that state of mind in which he knows exactly what he wants and is determined to get just that. I shall now introduce John Wanamaker, the late Merchant King of Philadelphia. On numerous occasions during the early part of my business career, said Mr. Wanamaker, I found myself in need of funds for the operation of my business, which I could not procure through any of the usual commercial or banking channels. On every such occasion, I made it my business to go out to the park and begin walking, thinking as I walked of new sources of approach to the solution of my problem. On one such occasion, I needed a very large sum, due to the fact that we had had an off-season and found our shelves stocked with merchandise we could not convert into ready cash. I made up my mind not to go back to the store until I had solved my problem. I kept my mind on it every second. At the end of about the second hour, an idea burst into my mind that enabled me to walk right back to the store and raise the necessary amount of money within 15 minutes. The strangest part of the experience was the fact that I did not think of that idea at the start. Controlled attention plus definiteness of purpose formed the combination that served Mr. Wanamaker in this instance. Perhaps applied faith was a part of the combination of principles he used, but of that he made no mention. He did say, however, that I doubt that there is any such reality as an unsolvable problem, for the man who has learned how to hold his mind on his problem with a firm determination to find its solution. That was the equivalent of saying that there is no such thing as an unsolvable problem for the man who knows how to use faith. Now let us hear from Dr. Elmer R. Gates, one of the distinguished scientists and inventors of 3 decades ago who collaborated in the organization of this philosophy. "There is some hidden source of power," said Dr. Gates, "which comes to a man's aid when he sets his mind on a definite goal and becomes determined to attain it. With the aid of this power, I have uncovered the secrets of more than 200 inventions, not one of which existed in my accumulated knowledge at the beginning of my search. It is possible to fix the attention on a given problem and to keep it there until the solution of the problem seems to float into the mind from the air. The greatest of all problems is that of maintaining sufficient willpower to keep one's mind concentrated upon a single purpose long enough to enable one to tap this mysterious source of inward sight." When asked to explain what he meant by the term inward sight, Dr. Gates replied, "I have reference to the sixth sense, through which the subconscious mind seems to yield the answer to problems submitted to it in the mental attitude I have described." Remember, these men were among the most distinguished men of achievement known to the people of America during their lifetime. Each was a recognized success in his own field. Let us have a word now from the late President Woodrow Wilson. "When the request came from the German military authorities for an armistice in 1918, said Mr. Wilson, "it presented one of the greatest and most profound problems of my 2 terms in the White House. I knew a decision had to be made. I knew that the lives of thousands of people depended upon that decision, and I knew that I had to make the decision. I laid the request aside for a few minutes, closed my eyes, and became determined to seek guidance from a source greater than my own faculty of reason. In a little while, I picked up the paper and walked out onto the rear porch of the White House, stood there with my eyes closed, the paper clenched in my hand, and asked for divine guidance. I was resolved not to rely upon my own judgment alone. In a little while, it was not more than 5 minutes, the answer came. It was so definite, so obviously sound, that I went right back to my study and wrote the reply in shorthand. Subsequent events proved that I made the right answer, for it was but a little while after I sent it that the German Kaiser had been dethroned by his own people and was on his way into exile." What was this strange power on which the war president relied for his answer? He made no attempt to explain it. One can only surmise as to what he believed it to be, but there is one fact of which there is no doubt. The president forced his mind to seek the solution of a grave problem, and it produced the desired results. His experience was controlled attention of the most profound nature. It appears that controlled attention is more effective during an emergency, when one is forced to concentrate his thoughts upon some definite problem. And let it not be forgotten that controlled attention has a great deal of power when it is motivated by fear, but the power seems to be limited to the medium of physical expression of power. When frightened, a man may develop great physical strength because he concentrates all of his efforts in some particular direction, but this sort of power is small indeed in comparison with the spiritual power that becomes available through the emotion of faith. Controlled attention, inspired by faith, is a far different power from that which is created through fear. If Woodrow Wilson had concentrated his mind upon his answer to the German government's request for an armistice in a spirit of fear, I doubt that he would have received the sort of guidance that he did, which enabled him to send an answer that put an end to the former Kaiser of Germany. Dr. Bell discovered the principle which made the telephone possible as the result of an emergency occasioned by his wife's deafness. Of course, the significance of the emergency is this: it causes one to control his attention in a more highly concentrated form than he would under ordinary circumstances. It appears that these unexplained results, sometimes called miracles, experienced by people who rely upon their own minds, generally occur under the stress of some emergency, when by the very nature of the circumstance they are forced to intensify the concentration of their thoughts upon a definite subject. Two factors are always present under such circumstances. First, the emergency steps up the vibration of thought to a highly intense state of emotional feeling. Second, that emotion is concentrated upon one definite major purpose. The purpose of controlled attention, as far as this philosophy is concerned, is that of enabling one to bring together all the departments of the mind and harness their combined power for use in connection with a given purpose. That is what controlled attention amounts to. It stimulates coordinated action by 1. The faculty of the will, 2. The faculty of the emotions, 3. The faculty of reason, 4. The conscience, 5. The memory, 6. The faculty of the imagination, 7. The sixth sense, 8. The subconscious section of the mind. And it seems a reasonable hypothesis to assume that the combined forces of these departments of the mind make direct contact with infinite intelligence under any circumstance which brings all of them into action simultaneously. This hypothesis seems all the more logical because it has the endorsement, in about the same terms in which we have described it, of the late Thomas A. Edison, Dr. Elmer R. Gates, Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, President Woodrow Wilson, Andrew Carnegie, and many others equally capable of reaching a logical conclusion on so profound a subject. The facts upon which this hypothesis is based, with one exception, are known to be accurate. It is known that the combined power of the eight factors of the mind, when they are coordinated and expressed in action through controlled attention, enables one to perform deeds which border on the miraculous. The source of power that makes this possible has not been isolated definitely, but the results are so astounding that they could not be attributed to any power short of infinite intelligence. The burden of this lesson, however, is not to define the source of the power, but to describe workable methods by which it may be drawn upon and used in connection with the daily problems of men. In the performance of this responsibility, I do not have to rely upon hypotheses, for I have carefully tested and accurately proved formulas on which to depend, formulas which I know to be sound and practical because they have been used successfully by men of outstanding achievement in every walk of life. More than 500 men of this caliber, who collaborated through a long period of years in the organization of this philosophy, were specifically questioned on this matter of controlled attention. And here is a brief transcript of what some of them said. Asa Candler, founder of the Coca-Cola business. My opinion of the value of concentrated effort can best be stated by mention of the fact that we spend a huge fortune annually for the sole purpose of concentrating the attention of the public on the name Coca-Cola. It may interest you to know that this name is worth many millions of dollars, but it would soon become worthless if we neglected to keep the public's attention concentrated on it. Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Motor Company. My whole life work speaks for itself as to my opinion of the value of concentrated action.